Welcome to the Emory Arts Creativity Conversations podcast. This podcast features conversations from the endowed Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversations series. The following conversation was recorded on February 22nd, 2023. Emory alum and Broadway actor Garrett Turner discussed his journey at Emory and the artistic choices he made that led to his role playing Ike Turner in the traveling Broadway production Tina, the Tina Turner musical. Rosemary McGee moderates. For more information on Garrett and his career on stage, visit garrett-turner.com. Enjoy.
So, Garrett, I have known you as an undergraduate. I knew you when you were a graduate student off, you know, in other parts of the world, and now as a professional actor. And I have to say, of all the roles that I envisioned that you might play, it never occurred to me that Ike Turner would be one of them. So that's very interesting in and of itself. Like, I could see Langston Hughes, and you did a Langston Hughes performance and play here. It could be, President Obama. It could be any number of people, but it turns out that it's Ike Turner. And so I'd like you to share with us a little bit. We're going to start in the here and now, and then we're going to do a little walk down memory lane as well. But what that's like, that kind of transformation from the Garrett Turner we know to the Ike Turner who's on stage and we also know a lot about.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. And I promise I will answer it in short order. But first, let me just say, what an incredible moment this is. My heart is fit to burst. Being back here at Emory in a room full of people I love, being interviewed as a part of the Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversations by Rosemary McGee is simply extraordinary. I'm just, you know, God is good. Yeah. So this is really beautiful. And I thank y'all for being here. And I thank you for...
Of course.
For doing this.
My pleasure.
I'm in the middle of the craziest and most extraordinary thing that I've ever done, which is this tour. It's my national tour debut. And I've been learning a lot everywhere I go. I'm number two on the call sheet. I'm playing a lead, and it's the first time I've ever had a wig cap built for a show. You know, before rehearsal started, they were like, "We need you to come in for a wig cap." I was like, "Okay, like, what's that?" And they fashioned this thing to my head, you know, and then I have four wigs I wear in the show. They perfectly fit my head. It's the first time I've ever had a dresser. I have an in-house dresser at every theater we go to, that helps me do all my changes. I have 11 costumes and more changes than that because I wear them multiple times and quick changes. And I've learned the utility of a dresser. it's the first time I've ever had two mic packs, you know, like I walked in. I was like, are both of these for me? They were like, yeah. I was like, why do I have two? They were like, well, in case one goes out, then you have a backup. I was like, well, I must be a lead on a national tour because that's never happened before. So it's just wild, you know? And all the get up and go, traveling with my wife, you know, all of that, of course, is just surrounding the fact that I do 8 shows a week. And not only that I do 8 shows a week, but that I do 8 shows a week playing Ike Turner. Who is an icon unto himself. You know, he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He won a Grammy the year that he died in 2007 for his own blues music. Mm-hmm. And he was a musical genius. And a force of a person, by which I mean he grew up in the 1930s. he was born in the 1930s, I should say, and grew up in Clarksdale, Mississippi, small town in the South. And, you know, his father was essentially lynched. It took him a couple of years to die after this white mob, you know, beat up his dad. But, and Ike was abused when he was younger, like sexually abused, and he went through. I mean, they were in abject poverty, and he was a hustler, and he would like feed chickens and sell stuff on the street, and you know, just to try and get by and help his family make it. And then he learned how to play the piano, you know, in the midst of all of that. He was looking through a window, and there was a semi-famous piano player in the South who he saw playing, and went in and was like, how do you do that? And started taking lessons and just picked it up, you know. It was kind of all by ear. Same with the guitar, which he's more known for as a guitarist. And then he started a band. Like, literally, it was like a school band that broke up, and then he was like, well, some of the guys, he was like, well, let's keep this going, and just started playing like juke joints and stuff, and they went from that to semi-acclaim in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And then one fateful night, he met Anna Mae Bullock, who would become Tina Turner, and essentially capitalized off of her talent and vaulted them into international acclaim.
Right.
Like, from being a black man in Clarksdale, Mississippi, to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so he did that incredible thing, but then he was also incredibly mercurial and believed the lie of patriarchy and was abusive to Tina, to his band, and just had this incredibly dark sort of underbelly. And so that's the person I am diving into.
Wow.
8 shows a week. And it asks a lot of you.
Yeah. What does that do to your psyche?
Yeah. You know, I have a ritual before the show that I do every show. And I take a Tibetan singing bowl. And, you know, I just circle it with the gong, and it makes this continuous tone. And so it's just a sort of tactile way of grounding myself. And then within that moment of pause, I take a moment of prayer, you know, myself being a Christian. And I just pray about whatever is I need to, you know, whatever's going on. And what I see it as is a way of grounding myself in myself before I allow myself to step into this crazy person, Ike Turner. And so I answer your question that way by way of saying I have to protect my psyche. Mm-hmm. In a very real way. And then I think, you know, there's something about the repetition of it that allows you to take it on and take it off. I mean, we've done over 170 shows. So you got to find a way to just come to work, boom, step in.
It's and like then the dresser, you know, you dress yourself for it and then you take off.
Precisely.
The clothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you about this phase and also, in a few minutes about other phases of your life, but what have you learned the most as a result of doing this role, both about the process you've learned about, you know, these customized wigs that you wear and a lot of the technical aspects of it and, you know, how a tour gets put together. Mm-hmm. But what else have you learned? And also, especially, what have you learned about yourself? I mean, and some of that you've already, you know, talked a bit about maintaining your own spiritual well-being, but other things that you've learned.
Yeah, I've learned that I can do it. That I can do 8 shows a week for months on end. That I can, you know, be a good husband, in the midst of everything, that I can go through the trials and everything that's placed on your shoulders as being a lead. You know, particularly for this show, I find that because of the abusive force that I am on stage, there's a kind of necessity to be a nurturing force off stage. And that's in relation to the Tinas, excuse me, because we have multiple women who play Tina, but also in relation to the entire cast, but also in relation to like the crew as well. I mean, there's like a small village that travels with this show. And in every theater we get into, there's a small village in that theater. To be rooted in myself, to be able to give to the audience, you know, the thousands of people who are there every night, but also to the people who are backstage, like who really need it in a sense. And I'll a short anecdote in relation to that is, you know, there was a dresser, she wasn't even my dresser, but she was just part of the team. And every time during one of my changes backstage, she would stand, you know, close to where I am and kind of just be on looking. I forget which theater this was, but, you know, after a couple of days there, I just noticed her and so I just went up and shook her hand. I was like, "Hey, I'm Garrett." And she said, "Hey," you know, and we just talked for a second. And then a few days later, when we were finishing up in that city, she came up to me and she said, "You know, I just wanted to thank you for shaking my hand when you did." She said, "I went through an abusive relationship myself and found that I was," this is her talking, "that I was really triggered, you know, even just listening to you on stage. And, you know, when you shook my hand, that really helped."
Right.
And that's just like
a shared humanity.
Wow. You know, like
it's that connection.
And it was, and it's so important, yeah. You know, it's so important. To love on people at every stage of the process. And that's, you know, on stage, backstage, when I come out of the door and my friends are there and these reunions and still having, you know, the energy in the tank to when I come home to be like, "What's up, baby? You know, what do you want to watch tonight? Like, what are we doing?" And God has given my spirit the fortitude to be able to do that. And I think it's a real gift and something I hope to, you know, nurture and cherish.
Wow. Right. Well, it sounds like you've been doing a lot of reflection and no doubt you reflected on the past. By the way, I've been to Clarksdale, Mississippi, and that was in more recent years. And I know what a small, you know, challenging place that is even today. So I can only imagine what it was like when, you know, Ike Turner hailed from there. But tell us a bit about a place that presumably is more flourishing. It certainly embedded your flourishing spirit, and that is Florence, Alabama. We have a colleague who couldn't be here today but wanted to be, Hank Klibanoff, who also a very creative person. He's from Florence. I know somebody else who's an extraordinarily creative person from Florence, Alabama. So what's there? What's in the...
Yeah.
Those are like three different little ecosystems within this place of Florence. But yeah, what happened for you and to you there? What gave you life when you were there?
What a wonderful question. There's so much to say. So I'll try and get all of it out. I love, you know, Leslie, you just said "What's in the Water," which is honestly, there's an actual documentary about the Shoals area, because so I'm from Florence, right, and it's right across the Tennessee River from Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And Muscle Shoals, Alabama is the Fame Recording right. Studios, which where some of the seminal soul tracks of the 60s and 70s were recorded. So Aretha Franklin, Rolling Stones, the Staple Singers, and a lot of other folks.
So it was in the water.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, that's what this documentary claims. It's like, oh, there must be something, you know, in the murky depths, you know, of the water. But Hank Livinoff and I have spoken about that, and we don't quite believe, you know. It's like, it's cool to kind of construct a myth around the place and can be helpful for, I don't know, advertising for people to come there or whatever you need. But it's like, but what is it really, you know? And I think it's like a wealth of spirit in the people, you know? I think like the Bible Belt, for all of its reckless conservatism, is also like full of a lot of people, full of love, and you know, people who nod at each other when you walk past each other in the street, and people who are fully committed to community, and you know, that's what I feel in sort of my legacy there. I grew up going to Wood Avenue Church of Christ, you know, shout out to Wood Avenue. It's a church where my dad is still an elder, and my mom and dad attend, and those people like loved on me real good. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the way that we like interpret scripture ends up being quite different, but like we start from the same Jesus and the same sort of wellspring of love. And I felt that at Mars Hill Bible School, which is the high school I went to, which is also affiliated with the Church of Christ. And so just to give you an idea, I'm talking about two services on Sunday, Wednesday night Bible study, Bible class every semester at school. We had chapel before lunch every day, which is like a 15-minute devotional that we had. This is notwithstanding summer youth series and winter youth series, where the different folks from the Churches of Christ would get together on, say, a Tuesday night, and a youth pastor would speak. This is notwithstanding Challenge Youth Conference. I'm talking about, like, community, okay, yeah. And commitment to that. And
it was in the holy water.
Yeah. Well, but there's just so much love in that. And what I think, how I think about that is the support, right? So like the Secret Sisters is a Grammy-nominated duo of Lydia and Laura, who Lydia graduated in my same class from Mars Hill. And this incredible folk duo. And the thing is, to be an artist who goes on and creates that kind of music and continues it in a way to get to the Grammys, you have to have support. And like, our families have loved on us. You know what I mean? I think like the Civil Wars, there's also a group I'm throwing out, you know, the folk group that some folks might know. They're based out of New York, out of Florence, Alabama. Who else? Alabama Shakes. Brittany Howard is from Athens, Alabama. It's like 30 minutes down the road. So like, there are these people, you know, creating this art. And I think it has so much to do with like the love and the spirit coursing through the community. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And it also sounds like you bring that with you wherever you go, that your hometown and your support system and your faith and your beliefs is traveling with you wherever you have wandered, including your wandering to our quadrangle here at Emory University. And tell us what you thought you were going to find here, and then tell us what you did find.
Wow. I think one of the miracles of the way I have navigated life up until now, which was not intentional, it wasn't like a masterminded thing for myself. It's just
a strategic plan.
It was just how I went, is to not have that many specific expectations. So that's kind of my answer to the first part of your question. I was undecided in terms of what I wanted to study. I didn't have like a grand idea of what college would or should be, you know? I didn't have a 5 or 10 year plan. My sister was here. Hey, Laura Turner Smothers, just an incredible woman who leads Joy Village School in Athens, Georgia, thriving for Black students K through eight. You know, she was already here and she was already famous because she was a better basketball player than I was. And she ended up being the captain of the basketball team here at Emory. So when I got here, it took me a while to move from Laura's brother to Garrett, you know. But in thinking of coming here, I was like, well, Laura's been having a great time. And I visited the campus and it seems really cool. And essentially it came down between Emory and Vanderbilt. And Emory was blacker and Emory gave me more money. And I was like, well, that's a nice combination. So I'll go here. But I got here and I didn't know. I had no idea. I really didn't even know about Songfest, which is Songfest still happening? Yeah, which is this like extraordinary things that happens in the first week the freshmen get here and everyone like learns a dance like as a dorm
right.
And just performs in front of everyone else. And like, and I did that the first week and it was right up my alley and I was making all these friends and it just took off from there, you know? I really think, you know, college, I just remember Barack Obama would always say, you know, college being the best pathway to the middle class, you know, and I think in a lot of ways it is. I also think in a lot of ways it's absolutely not necessary. Like the internet exists. So, you know, like we can educate ourselves in so many ways. We don't have to come to college to do it. But I think
we try to keep that a secret.
Yeah,
there,
sorry.
No, it's public.
But like, I think like this liberal arts, kind of private university works really well for some people and other people it really doesn't.
Yes.
And for me, it worked really well. Like I was the way I'm built, the way I like to think, the way I like to network. It was like, boom, boom, boom. It just started clicking, you know? And I ended up getting a music major by the end of my first year, not career minded, you know, but really just, I was like, I really love singing and I want to learn more about this. And so I majored in music performance. And then I was like, I should probably major in something else because I don't know what I'll do with this. And so my second year, I majored in creative writing.
That was another useful skill.
Yeah, I was like, well, this means job security. No, but it was literally just me being like, what do I love? And let me lean into that. And that's how I think things opened up for me at Emory. I sang in Ahana a cappella group all 4 years here. And my last year I was music director and that was like a bedrock of family here. And then, you know, the best man at my wedding was Davis Burgess. Him and Anthony Otto were my co-best men, both of whom were graduates in my class at Emory, some of my best friends. And like, and the last thing I'll say is, it was really like the education came through the friends who I met. You know, there's Florence, Northwest Alabama, beautiful place, but limited scope. Mm-hmm. And so when I got here, and I met folks who were Jewish, devout in the faith, I mean, you know, and who were Muslim and like challenging my worldview, but like also like who like loved me like friends and like I loved them. And it was like, whoa, it's just, you know, it's just so much to learn. And so I really was filled up in many different ways.
So it's not just the physical environment and location that opened you up. It was people of, you know, various beliefs and backgrounds and trying to, you know, find their own way and navigate their own way. Well, I know you had some pretty instrumental professors here.
Can I just say, that is exactly what I was just thinking. I was like, I didn't shout out the professors.
This is the next phase. This is the next phase. So talk a little bit about that. And then I have a few notes from a couple of them. Both of them sent me an email today, say, sorry, can't be there, but, you know, and I'll share that in a second. But, you know, you want to talk about that a little bit more broadly? What it meant to you, the classes that you took and what you gained and how you grew there as well?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, Michael Evenden is sitting right here. I took this brother's history of theater class, the first part, I think. And I was like, whoa. I just had no idea how substantively one could articulate what a piece of theater is doing. You know what I mean? So that, I think, is how my eyes were open. I was like, there is a richer world here than I could have ever seen myself.
Plus, you probably learned what a dramaturg is, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know what? So to be supplied that vision. A next person I would mention is Dr. Rudolph Byrd. Mm-hmm. Rest in peace. You know, he was my mentor, and he brought the Mellon Mays undergraduate fellowship program to Emory. He founded the James Weldon Johnson Institute, and I took his African-American literature class. And I think so much of the experience of college is being so dumb and not even grasping how dumb you are until you start to encounter people and you're like, wow, it's kind of, as I started to learn how immature I was, there was like almost a crushing weight of that I had to deal with. Like, I mean, I remember I literally apologized to Natasha Trethewey a few years ago for just like not understanding how blessed I was to have her and people like Kevin Young in the department and people like Rudolph Byrd, who took me out to brunch at the Georgian Terrace Hotel, where I had like watermelon juice and we were just like talking about Alice Walker and who he introduced me to, you know. And Jim Flannery, Dr. James Flannery, who founded the theater program at Emory, who also took me under his wing, who I just did lunch with the other day. Yeah. Love this man more than I can say, who just like epitomizes an artist's spirit in terms of the vitality, you know? And it's just like, just how important, you know, that we regard the things that we do down to, you know, every inch of the set and like what it means, you know? And just to feel that. And he was a person who pushed me towards doing a Langston Hughes project that I did at the end of my time here, which the formerly mentioned Hank Klibanoff attended. And then years later, I got to work with Hank, and like just the wealth of people here is, as there are so many other people I can mention, but it was really, it just split my world open, you know, to learn from these folks.
Well, and I think you may have met Professor Flannery first in perhaps a Yeats class, or at least that's his recollection. Yeah. That's when he first met you. So that was in the note that he sent, and he was glowing about spending time with you yesterday. And then that, you know, taking a Yeats class with him led to you doing a work about Langston Hughes, right?
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, mm-hmm. when, again, that's not where you necessarily plan it out. You don't see the connection in advance, and then it happens.
Yeah, like, I mean, the wondrous poetry of William Butler mm-hmm. Yeats, you know, and to have the vessel of a Jim Flannery to give it to you is like just the most delicious thing. And of course, you know, Langston Hughes's poetry being just as delicious. Just because it was like, you know, there are all these poets who I admire. And I was a poet myself, and I was writing that in class, but also performing at like spoken word venues across the city. As I understand, Java Monkey and Decatur burnt down, which I was really sad to hear, but I mean, that place was so amazing. And then to have, just to like have someone push me towards the idea of, well, how could you thread these things together? And so the show that I wrote was called I Dream a World, The Life and Work of Langston Hughes. And it told the story of Hughes's life through his own work. And so kind of used his poetry as a vehicle. And so I read all of Hughes's published poems, and I decided, you know, which ones were necessary just in terms of being canonical Hughes, but also which ones could be used to tell his narrative. And I put in splices from his autobiographies, and then like there was, I think, six of us who did the show, and it was a performance of poetry. I had to do all this research, you know, in order to put the show together. There was music. Michael Clanahan, shout out, alum, played the piano. And I sang a couple of songs in the show that were like Hughes's poems set to music. And suddenly I stepped back and looked at it, and I was like, oh, these are all the things that I love in the same place. And it seems like that place is theater. You know?
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, I didn't know that was happening, but that was really
that a was a transformation that occurred in the course of that.
Absolutely.
Right. Interesting. So you mentioned that you had, and I remember being there for the show as well. I met your family who were all there, you know, definitely in full force and pride. And it was a really wonderful moment because I think those of us who were there could see this transformation taking place from somebody who's, you know, kind of scattered and, you know, taking everything in and soaking it in, but doing this and that and the other thing. And then all of a sudden, all those different parts come together and you see it.
Mm.
And that really launched you in a lot of ways. So when you, you know, subsequently were a Bobby Jones scholar and then a Marshall scholar, you've taken advantage of all the best that Emory has to offer in those regards. You know, that's when you started, you know, pursuing theater in a more kind of professional way. Am I right about that? When you were on the Marshall Scholarship in London?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That is when I finally had the gumption to say, let me try this out professionally. Yeah, and I think I describe it as, you know, God just took down every obstacle in the way of me doing this thing of performing. Literally like, okay, Garrett, you get 3 free years of school, like in the UK. And actually those last 2 years, you can just do whatever you want. And so it was God going like, so what do you want to do, Garrett? And I think there is so much that I was just kind of, even while I was applying for the Marshall, for instance, I think for the Bobby Jones as well, though I did the Bobby Jones first, like you're saying, I was saying I wanted to be a professor because, you know, it just seemed smarter to like live in the same place and have a sustained wage and, you know.
Benefits.
Yeah. So I was clinging to this sort of middle-class stability of my upbringing. But finally, you know, the breaking point was the first master's degree that I did for my first year on the Marshall was at Queen Mary University of London. And I did a master's in theater and performance. And it was really built for the artist scholar, though, you know, 40% artist, 60% scholar, maybe, right? And so I was thinking, okay, I'll have a time to like develop like maybe performance research as a methodology or figure out what I want to do. And 6 weeks in, I was like, I don't want to do this. I was like, the last thing I want to do is write a PhD dissertation. Because honestly, poetry has always felt like the playground of language to me. And it's literally like where you can just make up your own rules. There are a lot of like rules and like things that structures that you can follow within. But there's this liberation of like, well, what are words? And how do they break down to the unit and the syllable and next to each other on the page. And what does that mean? And that's just so exciting. And then like MLA citation is like the antithesis of that to me. I was like, it's
deadening.
I don't want to do that. Here's the thing. I love people who do and can and find, you know, cause that's what I saw in Dr. Bird is like, the absolute necessity of someone to be able to sing the song of the artist in terms of what our work does. You know, I think he did that for Ernest Gaines, for Alice Walker, like to, because, you know, artists create and we put something up and then it's like, well, what is it? I think it's such an important question. Or like, what does it mean? Or what is it doing? Or how do we relate to it? And the artist often can't answer all those questions. Like, or doesn't want to, you'd be like, well, I don't know. Well, y'all figure it out. You know what I mean? So to have like someone who like studies it and finds like language and a way to articulate what is happening here actually like fills out the meaning of a piece of art, like in, you know, whatever world of the art that allows it to like us to grab onto it in a particular way. And that's, I mean, it's so important, but I just felt like, you know, my urging, my calling, my passion moving towards like the performance thing. And so that's what I did. I actually changed what I said I was going to do on my application for the Marshall for my second year. So I did 2 1-year masters, and I ended up doing a master's in music theater at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama in London. And I think it was a good move.
Well, what incredible preparation for what you're doing now. Yeah. You had no idea what you would be doing now. And that's what you were saying earlier. It's not like you've planned everything out. It's as things, opportunities have arisen, as you've, you know, reflected on what you want to do and what you don't want to do. That has pushed you forward. Well, I want to mention another strong Emory connection. And there's a lot of things we're not covering because every one of these avenues has lots of byways. But quite recently, within the past, you know, several years, in any event, we mentioned Hank earlier, but you also became maybe in the first group of the Arts and Social Justice Fellowships. And you work closely with Hank in that. And what he has to say about that, our friend from Florence, is that he was with a class of 16 students, helping them shape 16 separate and powerful representations, dialogues and monologues. And he says, you brought great creativity out of the students with this difficult material. So the question is, you know, you've experienced that, people bringing it out of you and, you know, igniting it. And, you know, how did you know how to do that with them? How did you figure that out?
Yeah. how did I know? You know, I an amalgamation of many things. It's like, you know, that being a spiritual being, I think there are things that God just puts in us. Like, you know, I would describe as gifts to know how to navigate certain situations, but then also watching a lot of really astute educators throughout my life lead spaces, you know, and the importance of how to lead a space. So, I mean, what was really important in that circumstance, I mean, first for context, that was in 2020, fall of 2020, after, you know, the summer rebellion, after George Floyd was murdered, and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. And so Emory, as far as I could see, created that program as a kind of response to everything that's going on. And I appreciated that there was a response at all, you know, excuse me, from the arts at Emory. But in particular, something that was generative, you know, it was like, let's create something in response. And so Hank, for years here, has been teaching this class, which has evolved, you know, into a podcast and its own institution called the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project. And I was brought into the class, and the idea was I was to attach a creative component. That obviously was something to do with social justice, since it was the Arts and Social Justice Fellowship. And I mean, the great thing was that the material of the class already surrounded social justice. I mean, what they do every semester is to research a racially motivated murder that went unpunished, generally in Georgia, generally between, I believe, like the 30s and 50s, but our class was a slight aberration in that we went back to 1906 and studied the Atlanta race massacre. So it's just volatile and triggering material that you're asking students to sit with for the course of a semester. And so to how to approach the space, I think, was one of just utmost care. You know, for ourselves and our own spirits, but also of respect, of course, for each other, but for the fallen, you know? And so one of the things that I did at the beginning of that class was to have us say the names of all of the victims who were named that we know. I mean, so there were hundreds of victims, right? But there are only so many names that we know. And so I would say one and the class would repeat it. And we just went through that. And, you know, that kind of thing was really important to acknowledge that the care and respect necessary to dive into the material. And then it was really just like, well, how can we deal with this, something so traumatic and tragic, to make something creative? And my thought was, well, what if they each made a scene that was not like in the midst of the massacre, but like just before, either just before or sometime after? And so we think about who these people were, like right up until this happened.
Leading regular lives.
Yeah, or from what we know of them, like where they went or could have gone afterwards. And it was to hone in onto like a specific locale, a specific person, to keep it like as simple as possible. Because not everyone in the class, you know, were artists, right? There researchers, a lot of different people from different majors. And so, yeah, from that, it was just very tenderly nudging people towards believing that they could do it. And I really think the product was, you know, honestly, I think it's something that, like, it could be a model for education. This crossroads of history and theater, of a way to appreciate like a historical period by having to put yourself into these people's shoes, you know, as it's a totally different vantage point. And I think there's a lot to be done with and a lot of ways it could be used. You know, if I had more time, maybe I would try to be
a college professor.
Indeed, look, there's time. But yeah, that's what we did. And kudos to the students, because they were just 1,000 times more conscientious than I recall being when I was a student, and really took to it with aplomb.
What an extraordinary opportunity for them.
Yeah.
And for you, and I know the CCA or Arts at Emory, you know, were the people that brought this whole program together that's meant so much. Well, I'm going to close my part of this conversation by asking a question I've asked others that I've had conversations with, or a version of it. This would include Salman Rushdie and also President Carter, someone, both of whom we have in our hearts, members of our community who have struggled, and especially this week, President Carter. So I had, you know, the supreme honor of sharing this time with them. And I asked them either words of advice that they might offer from their, of course, much more elderly position than yours, but also, or thoughts of inspiration. I'll share with you what each one of them said when I asked that question. Salman Rushdie said, never be afraid to speak out. And so that's, you know, something that resonates with us and that we hear more deeply in this moment. And President Carter said, and he was speaking to a class of Emory students, he said, join the Peace Corps.
I love it.
So in terms of, you know, all of us are students at heart. All of us are seeking inspiration. All of us are creative beings. So, you know, share with us what you think and what maybe you shared with those students about creative words of inspiration leading to creativity.
Yeah. Hold on to truth. And the truth will set you free. I mean, there are so many ways in which the entertainment industry, being an industry, will try to push you towards various motivations that are outside of what brought you there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what we have as artists is our truth, and you gotta stand in it, you know. And oftentimes it takes an incredible amount of courage and tenacity and belief to do that, but you gotta stand in it. I mean, I think that's why The Crucible is one of my favorite plays, you know, because it is my name. It, like, I can't give up the core of my being. Right. You know what I mean? Like, and you gotta believe that nothing is worth that, or else things will just rip you apart. And I don't want to downplay how difficult it can be to speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. I was an understudy for Thoughts of a Colored Man on Broadway. Our show closed early due to COVID, the Omicron crush. This was the end of 2021. And a week or a little bit longer before our show closed, we had one weekend where there were 9 people in the cast, 2 understudies, 7 men on stage, all Black men, an extraordinary moment for what we call Broadway. And 2 of the guys were out. One was sick, one was gone. And the other understudy, my colleague, understudied both of their principal roles, right? And so he can't go on for both of them. And so essentially we don't have a show. And we all as a group, the cast, I mean, met backstage because the guy who was sick was like, no, maybe I can muscle it up and get out there and go on. And we were on the phone with him like, bro.
Don't do it.
No. Like, your health is more important than all of it, right? So that's already one way of standing in your truth. And then we essentially like make that decision as a group. And then the stage manager calls me over to the office. I'm talking about this is like 40 minutes before a couple thousand people or less than that. I think it was a smaller house. We're about to come in and watch this, you know, history-making Black Broadway show. The stage manager calls me in. He was like, the lead producer is asking if you would go on for Wisdom. Wisdom, all the characters are named after emotions. Like you're, like Emma said in her introduction, I originated the role of Anger out of town at Syracuse Stage and Baltimore Center Stage. And then I was one of the 2 people who they kept in the cast for the Broadway transfer, right? Except I understudied on Broadway. And so stage manager calls me in. It's like, lead producer is asking if you're going for Wisdom. Wisdom is like he's been married for 42 years, is what we know about his age from the script, right? I'd been alive for 32, right? Also, that was not one of the characters that I had understudied. I had read for that role during the first day of rehearsal, literally the first day, because the person who was playing Wisdom couldn't be there. But I had never walked through it. I had never done it. Like, he's wondering if you can go on with a book in hand, like the script in hand, and just do it on Broadway in front of people. And I was like, as soon as I started to like to sort of think my answer aloud, the 20 seconds in, stage manager was like, oh, this is the lead producer on the phone. Here you go. Boom, hands me the phone. Garrett, hi, you know, how are you? I'm like, well, I've been better. Anyway, it was like, you know, can you do this for us? If you do, you know, I'll paint you as a hero in the press. You'll save the show. I said, no. I said, absolutely not. What I wanted to say was, am I the only person who cares about the integrity of this show? You're not thinking what this will be for the other actors who are out there with me, for me stumbling around, not knowing what I'm doing, looking like a fool, playing this old man in this show?
Name like, Wisdom.
Literally, is all you can see that you're about to lose however many hundreds of thousands of dollars and not like the spirits of the people? Look, I'm talking about speaking truth to power. You will find those moments where it'll be like, what's up? You know, and then boom, it'll hit the fan, and you gotta steel yourself as an artist to stand in your truth. And I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And you know what? We canceled the show, I think maybe two that day. And we ran for another week and it was beautiful. And then we had to close because too many people got COVID at once. And it was really sad, but it happened.
Right.
And we did 89 performances, 12 previews, 77 regular performances. I got to go on 10 times as three different characters. And it was an incredible experience. And that was meant to be.
Right.
And I'm so glad that I stood in my truth. So hold on to it, y'all.
Right. Well, thank you so much. I mean, that's really, really, it's truly inspirational, Garrett. And it's, you know, so delightful to have you on campus and to feel your spirit among us. And you always will be a part of this campus, which I know you treasure as well. And if other people have questions that you want to ask Garrett or just hear his stories, or I'm sure he wants to hear your stories too. Or anybody want to ask a question for the general audience? Okay, Maggie does.
I mean, I'm thinking kind of based on the story, very much about the student experience and kind of like when, like you're saying, when you were graduating, you didn't really know where you were going to go. I think I meet with students every day whose like main thing, like main existential crisis is like, when I walk across that stage and they hand me my diploma, what am I supposed to do,
yeah.
You know? And so I think I was just curious, very practically, I mean, this is not poetic, although I'm sure you will make it very poetic,
yeah.
Is like when you decided to fully just work as an artist, how did you kind of balance that with like living, you know, providing yourself a life?
Yeah.
And also with, you know, all of that, it's not a regular 9-to-5. You know, you can't like clock in and clock out and then be done. I'm sure you're like filming self tapes at night and, you know, and so it's kind of balancing that work-life balance.
Yeah. Thank you for the beautiful question. And I'll be brief. First of all, in relation to the existential crisis you mentioned, what a bullshit crisis that capitalism manufactures.
Yeah.
Disbelieve it. We're humans, we're alive. It's just, I didn't get on my capitalism soapbox here, so I won't. But it's just, you know, you're doing great, and we have to just keep going and taking care of each other and balancing life. Even that dichotomy, right, is that's what capitalism, work life balance. What do you mean life is something different than like it's just. Insane, literally, like the things that we're made to believe. But it's like, it's just, you know, catering. Catering is a great day job for an actor because, particularly in New York, because there's so much of it, and you can put together your schedule week by week, whatever hours you need, and you can call out last minute if an audition comes up. So that's been huge. I work for 10 different catering companies in the city. And it's been super helpful, but it's just, yeah, it's like, it's persevering and continuing to believe in why you came and that, you are worthy and that your voice is worthy. And then it's just, navigating the jungle of capitalism, which is not built for artists because I had 17 W-2s in one year. And you like, they people just don't build healthcare or anything in a way to like take care of us. So we just have to like, literally find a way. Like, yeah, thankfully I have healthcare through the union right now. You know, if you end up being a part of a union or something like that, but it's literally just like, okay, someone built this thing, you know, like maybe it was Alexander Hamilton, and it's really like ruthless the way that our society is built, and it's not my fault, but I'm here and I want to do this art within it. So taking into account that this craziness is not my fault, how can I just like find a way to keep my spirit intact, but also like have food to eat and provide for myself and family if need be, and then keep my artist spirit alive, you know? And it takes ingenuity. But there are a lot of ways to navigate it. And now I'm a resource of yours, so we should absolutely share contact info and when we can help hold each other up.
Yeah. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Creativity Conversations podcast. Find out more about arts on the Emory campus by visiting arts.emory.edu or following us on Instagram @EmoryArts.